wish I could break free back to where I'm supposed to be.
Welcome to the Sickle Cell Noise Podcast on the Pro Sound Web Podcast Network. I'm Chris Leonard and joined by Kyle number two because, well, Kyle, you are the shit. So, you know.
Thanks. Thanks.
How's it going, Coach
you
Kyle?
You can do coach. Coach will work.
Coach. I coached my first U6 team game tonight with my daughter. Her first time playing soccer. My first time coaching. It was interesting. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'll take all the advice you're willing to give me there, Kyle.
Yeah, man. Let's take some advice from our sponsors that help us out. RCF make great speakers. They have that new wedge. Remember the wedge that they brought out to us?
Yeah, at the 200th. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that thing sounded really good. I liked it a lot.
It did. Your voice sounded amazing through it.
That's what I heard. I heard that. I heard it was pretty.
I heard it too.
Pretty epic. Also, our friends at Allen & Heath, winning awards as usual with the Avantis again. I've been hearing a lot of good things. I think this next run, I really want to try out one of those little CTI 1500s. Mm. Impressive little console. I think, what was it, Drew Thornton used it for a long time with Billie Eilish. I saw some of their stuff. To do a size of that, you know, a tour of that magnitude and take out that small a console is very brave. And I took out an SQ5 by myself with Max on the last tour. And it was funny walking to front of house with the desk in my hand, not in a case. And everyone's got their, you know, huge consoles, the SXL, the, you know, Digico desks. And I just put my thing right in the middle of both of them. And it was kind of odd. But I tell you what, nobody looked twice after they heard it. It was great. And our friends at Rational Acoustics, SMART, the SPL program, the classes and things that they've been providing for our community. The best tip ever was the YouTube clips. And if you guys are new users and you can't get yourself to a class or have somebody to show you the ropes, the YouTube clips that are cut down into little segments are amazing. Like, I've even used them for just quick reference on transfer function and some other things. And we've also had a few guests on that are actually teaching the class now, not even in the United States of America. It's crazy. Like, they That's live true. Across yeah. in other time zones. Like, they're living in the future right now, teaching the class before us in America get to learn that stuff.
That's
in
right.
the Americas.
And I'll mention this now, I'll mention it again, but, you know, one of the things we're going to talk about tonight is John Huntington's book, Introduction to Show Control, along with the previous book, Introduction to Show Networking. Rational Acoustics has a bundle of that, for sale on their website. So you can go to rationalacoustics.com. That's one of the places that you can receive this book. We'll talk more about that, but I want to mention that while we're talking about Rational Acoustics. So, with that though, let's bring on Kyle number one, Kyle Jensen. We've had Kyle Jensen before, both as a guest, a co-host, all those things. I wanted to bring Kyle along because he's a little closer to the topic tonight than I am, and I needed someone smarter than me in the room, because that's typically good advice in life, is to have someone smarter than you in the room. So
I feel like you're giving me way too much credit there.
That's why I hang out with you guys still, because I'm still the stupidest.
And then I want to welcome back John Huntington. Welcome back to the show.
Yay.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad. So, for those who didn't listen the first time around, and I have not looked up to see actually what episode that was, it was a while back. It was like middle of the pandemic, probably. You know, so you've written a couple of books, Introduction to Show Networking, Introduction to Show Control. These are actually revisions of what your previously done. We'll get into that. You've been you were a professor for, what, 30 years almost, something like that?
Not quite that long, man. 24.
I'm not trying to age you there. Yeah. Feels like 50, no.
I get my last paycheck this week, so after early retiring after 24 years there.
That's right. I saw that in your blog. You have an early retirement plaque. that's posted.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
And my colleagues made that. That's when you have a CNC router around, you know, they made a plaque for you. Very nice. It was very nice.
Very nice.
It's incredible.
And I think what a lot of people like, which one of the reasons I like following you, is you have a you're very interested in weather and chasing storms mixed with photography, which I feel like that almost is a prerequisite. Like if you chase storms, you're into photography. Is that like, I think it's got like almost like a hand in hand thing, you know, like that goes together there.
Yeah, I think, well, to me, I shoot a little video, but I'm mostly a still photographer. And I think to me, like the still photo, and the people on the podcast can see behind me, there's like things, storms on my wall that, to me, that's like the trophy you get after, you know, once you get on these storms. So, and I also like the reason I like still photography in general is just that idea of like freezing the moment allows you to kind of go back, whether it's, and I shoot a lot of shows and stuff as well, but the going back and seeing, you know, freezing that thing in time just makes it really interesting. And especially storm chasing, because it's pretty intense and you don't have a lot of time to like stand around and be like, oh, although I always force myself to, just put the camera down for a few seconds and like just experience it when I do that. But off of like getting the photo, like afterwards, you can go back and like, oh, that's a look at this. And this was, I remember that road.
That's a stratocumulus chasing cloud.
Yeah, exactly. And I was just randomly driving by this like sculpture in Kansas this year. And I'm like, oh, I recognize that. It was like a sunflower sculpture. And I had a photo from 3 years before on that corner with a giant, you know, severe thunderstorm behind it. So it's just like these bizarre, you know, and the first tornado I ever saw was in a town called Roselle, Kansas. And I have a tattoo of that. It was my first tornado.
And that's so cool.
Randomly drove back through that town this year. So I'm like, oh, it's Roselle. So it's just random things driving across Kansas. So
I will say every single time that I open up Facebook and I see a picture of one of the storms that you've chased, I always kind of like take a second and just like I'm in awe of kind of the power that is able to be captured in those photos, which is so cool.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. And I always feel like it's always interesting that, you know, cause I just remember my experience of it, but no photo can ever really capture what it's like when you're, and these things are basically as tall as Mount Everest. And, you know, people like me from the East Coast, you don't see those kind of things growing up. And although things are recently, we've had a bunch of tornadoes in New Jersey and stuff, but the, just to see that thing from 100 miles away and just see this thing and then it's just moving at you at 30, 40, 50 miles an hour. Like it's pretty odd. And I thought like once I saw one, I'd sort of check it off the list and move on to the next thing. But that kind of like hooked me. So, and it's the whole process too, that, I mean, I can talk about this for 2 hours. I don't know. I spent the whole time on it, but also you're on the road, but you, when you wake up in the morning, you don't know where you're going to be that night. So you don't make a hotel reservation till like 4 or 6 o'clock, because otherwise you'll miss everything. So it's just the idea, because I think many people in our business, you pretty intense lives and often structured by a show's opening night or whatever, a tour or whatever it is. And to do something like that where you just sort of, I don't know where I'm going to be in 2 hours, where I'm 10 minutes, you know, and giving yourself over to that process is like, I actually find it relaxing, even though it's, you know, you drive 600-700 miles a day sometimes. So,
and I super
drove,
cool.
This year, chasing in a few weeks, I drove almost 10,000 miles. So,
wow.
That gets
old.
That's awesome. So, I want to do this. I want to go back to at the beginning of this book. I want to go back to 1990. and you know, you talk about you know, when you were pursuing, looking for information, you were in grad school looking for information on DMX and different protocols and things like that, that led you to writing your first book. Can you take me back there, what you were pursuing, what you didn't find, and what you initially created through that process?
Sure. And it was my first job out of grad school was writing for Theater Crafts magazine, which doesn't exist anymore, and Lighting Dimensions. So those two, it's kind of amazing because the people from those magazines are still doing that. So like Lighting and Sound America is my editor from Theater Crafts and stuff like that. So all of us, just like everybody else in our business, you know, they just move around from place to place, but they're all still here. But I was doing that and I was just looking for information. This was 1990, right? So DMX came out in 1986. So if you're an audio person, you know, that's the dominant lighting protocol. And went to the drama bookshop because back then this is pre-Amazon. I mean, Google was what, 2008 or something? I'm terrible with dates. So, you know, go to the drama bookshop and look through the shelves and there was just nothing. There was lots of books on scene painting. And I think there was maybe one on sound in those days. You know, it was pretty early. I was like, oh, there's just no information on this. And I had just written my thesis in grad school on connecting systems together. And so all of that led to, it was actually at the AES convention in New York. This is so long ago. It was still in the Hilton. It was 90, 91 or something. And one of the publishers came around and like, oh, we're looking for book evaluators. And I was a technical editor. So I'm like, yeah, I'd love to do that. And they had on the forum, like, what would you write a book about? And I'm like, oh, show control. Cause that's what I had, you know, I'd just written my thesis on. And then they were like, oh, we're interested. And that started a whole process, which is now, what, 30-something years later. And see, the original thing was, for show control, my definition of that is connecting two or more entertainment control systems together. So even if you have 12 computers in a lighting system or a big Dante network and a bunch of network, you know, remote control for your console or whatever, those are, or video or whatever it is, if it's inside one entertainment discipline, I can call that entertainment control system. Then if you connect them together, that's show control. So in those days, it was really a tweaky thing. And you really kind of like dig deep and program things in hex and do all the, you know, it's like wiring the right cable and you can only buy this gear if it supported this, had this protocol on it and all that kind of stuff. So the original book started out with that. And actually, the first edition I have on my website just as a free PDF now, if you want to go look at it, it's from 1994, oh, nice. I think. It's kind of hilarious now, but some of it's still mini DMX are all in there. I mean, and there's like, I can't remember if there's the first or second one. I think that's the first one. Yeah.
First edition of 1984. That's awesome.
I was pulling up a picture. Yeah, you can go download that and see it. And So that was sort of the idea of all, you know, it was meant about, you know, covering. You could be kind of comprehensive in those days because things were a lot simpler. And then over the years, I think I had in that edition, there's like 3 pages on Ethernet or something. And then I did 3 editions with a publisher and then they weren't interested anymore. So then I actually started self-publishing it. And that's when I renamed it to, I was actually flying back from Infocom one time thinking about it. And I renamed it to be Show Networks and Control Systems, because I think that was 2008 or 9 or something. And it was pretty clear that's where everything was heading. And then that just became this sort of, you know, 450-page monster book that trying to be comprehensive just kind of got out of control. But then what happened is that networking, of course, just took over everything. So I had intended, before 2020, I had intended to, like, extract out the network information in a separate book. And then I ended up with some time sitting at home by myself with the cat who's on the video behind me sleeping now during the lockdown. So I'm like, hey, here's the chance. So I extracted out all the stuff into the book that's now out that came out in 2020, I think, called Introduction to Show Networking. And then I wanted to take the big book out of print because I didn't really want to update it anymore. It just became a kind of crazy. But there's still a few things in there that were, obviously, like back in 1990, whatever, if you wanted to know about MIDI, I mean, you could go read the standard, right. But there wasn't a lot of information. Now, of course, you don't need to know the details of MIDI. Like, if you need to know what's on pin 3 of the connector that nobody uses anymore, you can go search it. So that I retired most of that information, but I sort of felt like the core stuff of like the show control process and all that was still relevant. So that I extracted out just when I actually went on leave from school over the spring semester. It's like unused sick leave. You still get paid. That's why my paycheck's still going. But so during that leave, I finally finished out the rest of that process and took the old book out of print. So the book came out in May this year. And that one, basically what it is like the show control process, the description, all that. But then the, you know, low level technical details, like I said, it's online if you need to find it. But then also B, you know, if you have something like, you know, QAB, which is a really, you know, super popular program that also it's started as an audio playback, you know, platform. And now it's a pretty sophisticated show controller. There's still not something like Media One Manager or something like that. If you really need to do super high-end stuff or very complicated stuff. You know, something like QF still not enough, but QF can do a lot. And they and every other software manufacturer now, they really package up those low-level details. So you don't have to know what bit 4 of the MIDI, you know, the second MIDI octet is anymore. That's what's in the old book, like just page after page of like bit tables and stuff. Now it's just, you just select the thing from a list and you get it. And then of course, networking is a huge part of that. So that's why it's sort of the two books are separate, but interrelated, where the networking book, if you're just interested in networking, if you just want to do, you want to learn, like, I mean, I don't really go into Dante or ABB or those type of things in the book, but all of those use standard IP protocols and same network switches and all that kind of stuff. That's what I cover in the networking book. And if you're going to build a show control system today, most likely it's going to be based around a network. So you still need to know that information. So the show control book references the networking book a lot, but they're sort of two separate things that interrelate. So that was a long-winded answer to that.
No, I mean, that's great. You know, it's interesting, as you were describing the need to basically update a book, specifically a technical book through the years, as not being an author myself, I've never had to think about this, but I guess that's something you probably regularly have to do if you want your book to be relevant, like as things progress. Is it, especially in the day and age we are, trying to revise this show control book, even the networking one, is it hard to figure out what information is relevant to stay in this book compared to all the where things are protocol-wise and how fast they will change and what are the foundational things that you say you need to know versus what are the things that are going to constantly change or the next, you know, product that's going to come out that's just using still the base layer of this information?
Yeah, when that, I can go down another hour-long tangent about this, but I think 2019, so a few years ago, I wrote two interconnected articles about the maturity. I'm going to answer your question. I'm going to lay a little foundation first. Yeah. About the maturity of technology in our industry. So being old, you know, I graduated from college in 1985. So, you know, during that time frame around 1985, there's this explosion of show technology in every area, lighting, sound, video, automation, rigging, you name it. And so the bulk of my career, we were just like, oh, crap, like every day you're trying to learn some new thing that didn't exist before. But then I started realizing around, and I ended up doing a bit of research to kind of put a date on it, but around 2010, the most things started maturing. And you can kind of look at it. So I write in these articles, and I have there's a video on my website of a presentation I did for Purdue sometime earlier this year, where I have some of the pictures and stuff from this. So if you look at like Beatles at Shea Stadium in 1965 or whatever that was, up to about 2000-something, there was just this dramatic, like, you know, Bob McCarthy always says, you know, like his brother was at that Beatles show at Shea Stadium, and he saw it but did not hear it. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the pictures, like it's a way under, you know, they and as Bob says too, like they basically promised a show and didn't have the tools to do the show.
Yep.
So by 2010 or so, like most of these things were worked out though. And if you look at a show from 2010 to now, I mean, maybe slightly, you know, it's the speaker du jour, it's the light du jour, it's the video projector du jour, whatever. But the form is pretty much mature. Like we've gone through this insane, you know, it's like this exponential curve of development, and then it really flattened out around then. So that's part of my thinking with the whole book is like all this low-level detail, which is now packaged up anyway, we don't really need it as much anymore. And I really think, you know, I would wager with somebody, you know, like, right. And I wrote in this article, you know, 4 or 5 years ago that basically, you know, I think if you look out at a show, you look at backstage at a concert or whatever kind of show 10 years from now. And I think I wrote this before the pandemic. I think the pandemic just extends this a little bit, that if you, you know, the show 10 years from that time until then, it's going to look pretty much the same. And the three areas that I laid out that were sort of the mature areas is like electrical power distribution. Like that's pretty well sorted now. And that's also like I'm on the ESTA ETCP panel that writes the certification exam. So that has a safety thing. And I encourage more sound people to take this test. Don't leave it all to the lighting department. So that's one, electrical power distribution. Like we build these crazy systems now. We know how to do it safely. you know, you don't really hear, at least in the States and North America, you don't really hear too much about, you know, electrical disasters anymore. Rigging, same thing, pretty well sorted out. I mean, there's always going to be an innovation or whatever, but the basics are sorted out. And then the third sort of those three core technologies is data delivery through networking. So those three things. So I think actually it's interesting. I mean, I look at the like networking book now, which is a couple years old. There's a few things I would change. I would update some things, but there's really not much I would add to it. Because I think now, you know, it's sort of like, and I think what's really happened along this is over the period of my career is this has really become kind of a trade now, which I think is great because having just retired from teaching, like the basics we can teach to people now. And I think nothing in any of the books I've ever written was taught to me in school. And that's not the fault of the schools. It's just that this stuff happened outside it. But meanwhile, you know, I had at City Tech where I just retired from, I mean, we had in the curriculum networking class for 10 years, I think, in there. So I think people that are paying attention with that, and I could have a whole other rant about education, but the challenges of it. But anyway, so yeah, I think it's interesting. And I had all this in mind updating these books is that I really don't put stuff in there. It's going to change a lot. But where you see today, like if there's going to be a new thing, it's really either in optimization of things, making it faster, cheaper, better, or maybe it's in its integration, which is show control, or maybe there's a new protocol here or there, you know, that gets developed. But if you're going to develop a control or audio video distribution, whatever kind of protocol today, you're going to build on Ethernet, right?
Sure.
It's just, you know, and whether it's fiber, copper, or whatever, you know, this just makes sense. It's just the easiest way to do it. And then you can scaffold off of all these things. And if you're going to put any device today that you're going to make, you're going to stick an Ethernet jack on it. And it's going to serve up a web page, and that's where you're going to configure it. Like, I don't see that changing anytime soon. So I think, and that's part of the reason, you know, I felt like with both these books, like now I sort of felt like after this years of trying to like catch up all of this stuff, I can kind of let it, you know, sit a little bit, but I don't think it's not, I mean, again, who I could have the newest thing tomorrow, but I've been saying this for a while now in terms of this, the maturity idea. And I think it seems to be playing out that way. Like, I don't see any, you know, and the other thing I always say is, you know, in show technology, the one big sort of thing that's always sort of like, I had dinner with some physicist like 30 years ago with a friend of mine who's like a genius guy who like didn't finish MIT. And they were saying like fusion is always 10 years out. So if you ask 10 years later, it's going to be 10 years away. Like right now it's 10 years away. 30 years ago. So, but the I think most of the things in our industry now, I think the thing that in our industry that would always be that sort of ultimate thing would be like, you know, volumetric projection. Like that's the Princess Leia thing from Star Wars in 1977 or whatever. It doesn't exist now, may never exist. But if you invented that thing tomorrow, what is it going to need? Rigging power and networking, right? you're gonna have to rig it somehow. You're going to have to get power to it. And you got to pump a bunch of data into it of whatever you want to project. How are you going to do that? You're going to get a chain motor and this and that. You're going to get some cam locks. You know, these things are, you know, and my first like week out of college, I worked for this crazy special effects company, and I ended up on these movie sets. I'm actually in a movie called The Manhattan Project. And like we did this we're simulating lightning in a big thunderstorm, coincidentally. And back then it was, you know, DC distribution with these like really illegal welding connectors called Tweakos.
Nice.
Really, really dangerous.
Tweakos. And,
wow.
Yeah. And you had to tape over the screw so you didn't get electrocuted. And I still remember I was on Governor's Island here in New York, on a big scissor lift with a lightning generator on it, like flash, big, you know, photo studio.
OSHA.
Flash. Oh yeah. So this one, I went to, you know, lunch break or whatever, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, I go back to get on this thing. I got electrocuted. I'm not dead. So I didn't get electrocuted. I got shocked. And I went to the electrician and he went and literally got like a zip cord with a couple little alligator clips, clipped that, tapped a stake in the ground, like 6 inches, like, oh, there, you're fine. So I spent the rest of the night like jumping on and off the scissor lift so I wouldn't be part of the circuit. That's where it helps to know about grounding and stuff. but yeah, so all these things now. So if you're going to have this Princess Leia projector or whatever you want to invent tomorrow, you're going to need these same things. And we're just going to scaffold off of those. So same thing like big speaker development. Okay, well now it's, you know, the speakers are so, speakers, mixers, whatever, everything is so good now, which was not the case when I got out of college, that, you know, the innovation is in incremental changes or integration or making it, you know, if you look at like, you know, recent speaker advertisers, they talk about how lightweight it is and how loud it is. Right there, it's like 150 pounds, 150 dB or whatever, right? They're not like, oh, this is a sound no one's ever heard before. Because it's not. Mm. It's better. It's a great speaker, whatever. But they're marketing it on a sort of innovation. I mean, the, you know, making it easy, you know, less trucks, less reading weight, less power.
It's a logistics marketing, not a... Right.
Yeah.
But when I started, you know, there was... There's two or three speaker manufacturers that were just way ahead of everybody else. Like they were in a league that nobody else was in. So you're really like dealing with this handful of manufacturers, or you're dealing with stuff that's really not in the same league. Now there's five, six, eight, you know, excellent speaker manufacturers. They're all really good mixers, whatever it is you want. You know, and if you think about like microphones, I mean, we're using microphones that are 50 years old now. So they're, they're pretty well optimized, right? I mean, maybe you stick an ADD converter in a mic or whatever. But so I sort of feel like the whole industry, you know, grew up. And we saw it in the, you know, like Bob McCarthy. I just keep talking about Bob tonight. But Bob is the real, like, pioneer. In our lifetime, we've seen the development of that entire field. And he and a few other people were around for that entire process. But that happened now. That's done, right? So I, and there's, you know, and I think the other thing about, like, standards, innovation – usually come into play. I mean, innovation is different because you could have a new technology that really kind of pulls something into existence. But most standards are really, they get pulled into existence. And right now, what's the big problem that, you know, do we really...
Getting paid.
Do we need to replace XLR connectors? Like, is there a big problem with XLR connectors so we have to innovate and come up with something new? I mean, we saw that in my career over, you know, speakers, right? We went from the horrendous quarter-inch connectors to the EP4, and then once Speakon came out, like, that's it. Like, you know,
everyone said, better. All right, we're going to use Speakon now.
Yeah, because they're cheap, they work well, easy to put on, they solved all the problems, and, you know, now there's other manufacturers have them, whatever. But I, so anyway, I've sort of lived through that. I think people come in the business today, like, which is, I mean, great for my students and stuff, they kind of walk into a mature field, and it's really now we talk more about, you know, really polishing things and getting that last, you know, 10% of whatever. And then it's really a matter of taste. Like, I like the sound of this or that, but it's not like, oh, this, we only one company makes a product that will deliver audio where we need it, you know, to be, or lighting or whatever. And we've seen the same thing in lighting and all these areas. Like, you don't see, you know, I saw the first moving lights. They're all analog control and these, you know, very light. You can imagine, like, you know, Genesis was one of the, you know, the funding behind the first Berry lights. You can imagine walking in and seeing that for the first time, but that's not really happening now. You know, you're seeing like incremental, you know, incremental changes. And now the example I use of this is like remote control follow spots, right? Really cool. It solves a lot of problems. Great safety thing. You can put, you know, follow spot where you couldn't get it before, but basically it's like a moving light head, a remote camera and some control stuff that basically all existed. They integrated all that. It's a great idea, but they didn't have to invent the whole thing from scratch.
So, right.
So we've seen, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask. So through all this innovation and where you've came with the last book, 24 years of teaching, what makes this easier to convey to students now? Is it less opinion based and it's more factual and there's like you've built like building blocks to be able to teach this. How has it changed in those 24 years?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. The, well, in the like show control stuff, you know, when I first taught that class, we were like wiring DB connectors and things like that. And it's really kind of remarkable to watch. So now basically if you're connecting things, it's a network, right? And you're going to use OSC and, and then, so that kind of low-level stuff is kind of like the students, they don't need – I mean, we taught the students how to you know, crimp an RJ45 connector, but then I just tell them, don't ever do this again. Just buy it because you're not going to compete with Monoprice or whoever. I mean, you know, if you got to fix something right for showtime. But also you can go buy, you know, a Cat5 cable at Walmart in Nebraska, right? You couldn't do that with some crazy, you know, BNC thing. Like when I started networking, it was all BNC. So yeah, a lot of the low level detail got packaged up. So they, you know, I still think they need to know the fundamentals, but we stopped teaching a lot of that super low level, you know, bit level stuff, which a lot of people really struggled with. And now it's a lot of things in the higher level stuff. It's in software, and most students today, 20 something today, you just hand them any piece of software, they're going to sort it out. Like, they really don't, you know, we just talked about QAB. You just put that in front of a bunch of students and give them a base, you know, the good practices and so on, that you have to teach that, but they'll figure it out in 5 minutes. So then I think you really focus on the, you know, really on the whole sort of package. But I do think always the basics, I think it's important. Like, you don't really have to know, you know, the pinouts anymore and that kind of stuff, but how things basically work, I think that's still important. And understanding the low level to be able to have like a conceptual model of how anything works, I think is really important for troubleshooting. And also just you understand. Oh, and I was just listening today to the last podcast you guys did, and I didn't finish getting all the way through it, but the idea that you're doing like blind A-B testing for ideas, I used to teach my students that all the time. I think that's great, because I think what's always, and you can't even teach this a lot to students, but I think what's always important is that thought process of A, you can delude yourself because I spent $1,000 on this thing and I want it to sound better. So you need, but it's not like rocket science to do basic testing. And I have a couple things on my website. I've done a couple, like I did one for Star Quad Cable a bunch of years ago that somebody wrote in one of the trade magazines that they put Star Quad on their show. And like the whole thing was dramatically better. And I'm like, I don't really buy that. And then, so then it was funny that I wrote this whole thing. I did a whole test with a automated piano and the same mic and just changing the cable. And we did this thing called as double blind ABX testing. So you have a known A, a known B, and an unknown X. So if there's a change between the two, and this is what maybe you guys got to that on the analog digital thing, but if there's a change, you should be able to hear the difference. And then you should be able to easily identify, I think I can't do the math, but like 8 out of 10 times in a trial, you should be able to pick X. And so we did this whole trial. No one came close. I had 30 or 40 people take the test. Nobody found it. And then, of course, I found out afterwards that like this whole thing never really happened. This guy sort of wrote this as an apocryphal thing. And somebody else I knew on the tour told me that didn't actually happen. So, but anyway, that testing idea, that's the type of thing I think. I mean, with the students, my students came from, you know, they're not, they're kids that are just, you know, first in their family to go to college and that kind of students. So they might have, you know, fumbled through something in their church. And then I think it's really, you know, the fundamentals are still the fundamentals. That never goes away. But I think they're able to get to a higher level, you know, product. I don't want to say more easily, but it's a more straightforward thing. Cause like when I was in college, we were like building speakers and stuff and we didn't know what the hell we're doing, but that's like, you know, in 1983, '84, whatever, like there weren't many good speakers back then. It was just a few like real rocket scientists making these things. And now you can go online and buy some pretty good product at every level of everything. So it's really more about, that's what I mean. It's more like a trade now. So you're kind of teaching them that. But I always think critical thinking, we're just talking about, is that never always important. And then, of course, you know, you can't teach attitude, but I mean, you can you know, try to tell people about, you know, meeting deadlines and then put them in, you know, situations where they have to work with people. I mean, all those things are, that never goes away.
Is there an art form to this? Is there any kind of art that you teach with show control? Like why people get chose to do that? Is there like a, is there an art to it?
Before you answer that, so I was going to ask a similar question, and I want to give Kyle Jensen here a chance to ask the question. So in the conclusion of the book, actually, one of the last sentences speaks to what you just said, Kyle, which is pretty cool. And I'll just kind of read it verbatim. It says, "I think today we are no longer significantly restricted by technology, but instead are only limited to the laws of nature, budget, and our creative imagination. This is something I couldn't have written in my first book in 1994. So I think it speaks into that. I wanted you to expand on the thoughts there. Along with the art side of this, right? So because like on the surface, and I think what Kyle's asking is like, okay, let's be honest, right? These are two very nerdy ones and zeros technological books, right? And it's like a lot of us, at least in the audio community, are very, you know, either artistic or creative, and it's hard to see the parallels between this like data crunch, you know, techie things, and then the art side of things, right? I mean, if I'm
But my man did haunted houses and stuff. Like that's right. That sounds so fun.
Yeah, and it's we did a this thing called the Gravesend Inn for 20 years, and we used to get like 6,000 people a year. And unfortunately, this is the big another hour I could talk about educational problems is that so many people I hear, you know, or either since this podcast or online or like bitching about like, well, the school should be teaching whatever. Like my school was, you know, we didn't have HVAC in the theater, you know, like there's no money for anything to do anything. And we were like fighting to get gear updated. It's turning around now. And they actually did hire somebody to replace me, which is great. So, but part of the thing they did is through like a series of understaffing and whatever, they basically killed off this haunted house. So this is the first year in 20 something that I'm not like scrambling right now to do it. And it had gotten too big anyway and stuff like that. But I would say even in that, like that was developed. I just myself, I've always been a technical backstage kind of guy. I mean, I've done theatrical sound design and things like that, but that to me was always more sort of like problem solving and things like that. I'm not somebody who just sits there and thinks about like, oh, I'd never really consider myself. I mean, there's always an art to what we do, but I don't find myself to be an artist. But I really enjoy working with those people and supporting them. So I think, but it is interesting. And like Show Control in particular, when that was, and this is the next thing I want to research now, like I always say, you have to, I had to retire from academia so I can do research on things that I want to do. It shouldn't be the case, but you get so like just burned out by the endless fights and bureaucratic fights and stuff. But in the mid 90s, when this, all this stuff started, like there was people back then that were arguing that the, you know, the Show Control title should actually be like a design credit, sort of like, you know, it's in the sort of theatrical idea of sound designer, lighting designer, Show Control designer, whatever. And I didn't really think at the time, anyway, that's a whole other story, but that didn't really come to pass. And it's probably just as well, because what's happened is all this stuff has just gotten integrated into the other system. So it became, in the early days, like if you just wanted to have, you know, an audio tape deck and have a lighting, you know, console chase the, you know, the time code on the audio and fire some light cues in synchronization with the audio, you would need a separate computer and a different program and all this stuff. And now, like any modern lighting console just has a timecode input, and we have a million ways to generate that and just stick it in there, just done. And that's sort of like the simplest type of Show Control. And that's what really fascinating to me was when the other part of that first book edition in the mid 90s was that it really seemed like, oh, this is becoming a new thing, you know, a specialty deal. Where, you know, like that place where I worked when I first job out of college, we built film projectors for Pink Floyd and Roger Waters and Rush and all these people. I remember just thinking like, this is insane because we're, you know, pumping QuickTrack into, who's the Pink Floyd drummer? Nick Mason? No, that's the keyboard. Who's the drummer?
Keyboard.
Oh, Google. Man. Yes, that's I think all our, my old.
Google
my
to
old,
the rescue.
My old credentials are revoked now. But anyway, we're pumping, you know, QuickTrack from a piece of film into, Kyle's going to tell us the drummer's name.
Nick Mason.
I can't read. Nick Mason. Okay. was I right?
Yeah, you were right.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. So we're pumping QuickTrack into Nick Mason's ear. And this just seems stupid to me because now we're like, we have all this stuff and we could kind of tell with the increased computer power that we're going to have this unbelievable flexibility that we can then hand back to the performers. And so I was like, I sort of was on this whole idea for probably 10 or 15 years, like, oh, once this like interactivity gets cheap enough, we're just going to have everything, you know, their musicians or whoever is just going to play and everything's going to chase them. It was totally 100% wrong. That didn't happen. We have the capability now. Basically, that's Ableton, right? You can do that in Ableton today. There's many other solutions. We did this, my colleague at school and I did this probably 15 years ago. I have terrible with dates. 15 years ago, we took a virtual orchestra system that you could conduct and use that to drive a video playback system and watch out. This is a bunch of years ago. We had it working, published it. Nobody cared. and if you look at like every show now has timecode on it, you know, I talk about this, like I do a lot of photography with my friends' bands locally here in the city. And I went to see one and there's this band opening from them. And I'm up there up close and a lot of the sound in these small places is terrible. So I have my earplugs in, I have my head right in the PA, but I'm up there to take photos and I'm looking around. I'm like, where is that guitar coming from? Like I couldn't figure it out. turned out that this little cover band, I've forgotten what kind of weird whatever they were doing, but they were like playing track live. And I'm like, A, that just seemed insane to me, but clearly the tools are available. I didn't even, there's no like technician back. I remember back in the day, I think it was UB40. A friend of mine toured with them as their tape operator. They had like a multi-track tape deck, you know, and that's what it would take, like this huge, big old 2-inch, you know, reel backstage to do tracks. And of course now it's just every show, you know, lots of ones people, general public wouldn't know it's there. So, and this is the thing I want to research in the big picture, is that the idea of this sort of interactivity, it's easily doable now. Nobody cares. Everybody, meaning musicians and, you know, dancers and performers, directors, they seem very happy just to lock everything down to time code, and they don't, that's fine. So that's the next thing I want to research, is talk to a bunch of musical directors and say, you know, you have all these tools, like it's there, you already got it. Why, you know, why does anybody care? And I always think about this again being an old story, but I did sound for a dance concert once. And so I can't remember what the music was, but I went out and bought a CD of it. The music, I play it back, you know, and the dancers come in and they freaked out. And they're like, what? Like, the tempo's all wrong. I'm like, it's the CD. So it turned out that they had been in the rehearsal room with a cassette, and the cassette actually stretched and slowed down. And so they had done their entire, they corrected themselves, but they were like, you know, they could hear the tempo and they freaked out about it. So
that's wild.
Yeah. And the other one, I'm talking about drummers tonight, but the, was it Larry Mullins Jr., the U2's drummer. There's a great story about I forgot which album it was, but they're in the studio with Brian Eno, and they were complaining about the click in the studio. This is a long time ago. And so I think it was Brian Eno, but anyway, he's like, look, no, it says, you know, 107 beats per minute or whatever it was. And it turned out, but the, you know, the drummer like forced him to tune it up a couple BPM. Turned out that his, whatever his metronome was out of calibration, and the drummer was right. So he had absolute tempo.
Wow.
Which is pretty amazing. So this is why, to me, being, and again, I think to wind it all back around to like the art side, me just being like a hardcore technical guy, like, that's amazing to me, because it feels like, oh, we would just want to let them just play whatever they want. And of course they want to float around. You don't want to just have like a drum machine, you know, but you know, to see the number, and it's funny now with these, you see these like kind of videos, you know, where there's some, the drum tech is like tapping the drummer's leg for the click or something. And it's just like, really, you need that? But they do, you know, so, because they don't really want the flexibility, it seems like. So this is what my next thing I want to research. But anyway, that was another long-winded tangent. But I think to me, though, I think the idea, I think these are now, like show control in particular is really just a tool for creative people. And I think the technical people can help them out. And it was interesting, you had, I'm just like drawing a blank on every name. I think it was Jess Jacobs was the playback tech you had.
Yeah, Jess.
Two episodes ago.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Great episode.
And I was listening to that driving back from Storm Chase or whatever. And I'm like, that's show control. You know, what she's doing. And I sort of realized, I honestly hadn't realized how sophisticated that realm had got. But she was talking about, oh, I'm doing this and I'm sending time code over here and I'm doing that. I'm like, yeah, that's show control. So I realized, like, if I do another edition of the book, I'll probably take an example. So I want to go backstage in one of these shows and see what they're doing, which often they're a little secretive about. You know, they don't want people, the artists don't want people knowing what's in track, you know. But yeah, that's the same principle, same everything. So I think the idea, so the show control now, it can be as simple as time code. It can be as sophisticated as an interactive haunted house, you know, triggered by sensors. That's what we did. And then I think too, you know, like we had many, many people go through this haunted house. And if you ask anybody if they know they're triggering anything, they would have no idea. And in that case, it's fine. We sort of, that was, you know, gave a different experience for them. And a lot of that's because we, you know, I've been under the Haunted Mansion at Disney, you know, those cars are basically like a big roller chain on their side, right? They control where the people are. And a lot of the new things, like I tell everybody, go see Rise of the Resistance. It was both Disney's. And it's a few years, it's pre-pandemic, so it's, 3 years old. Most amazing dark ride ever made. I don't think anything's come close to it yet. But in that, they're controlling where the people are. So they can do a lot in terms of the show. you know, what they're presenting to the people, because they're putting the people in this position that they're moving over here and doing this. Like, we couldn't do that. So our haunted house was sort of more like a golf course where people play through at their own speed. And it really was fascinating to watch, you know, some people would kind of play through, some people would merge, some people would run backwards through the whole thing. My favorite thing was, like, somebody went through and the other trick that we never told anybody that was really, really great was that, that the turned out when you exited, you had been on camera the entire time through, and everybody who had already gone through was watching you. And it turns out this is an 150-year-old idea from Coney Island, where you used to exit the steeplechase ride, and they had this blowhole theater where people would, there's, you know, you can find old YouTube video of this. And they would, you'd exit, and there'd be like a little person and a clown would like torment the people that came off the ride. And then other people who had just been tormented would watch it. So this was the same, my friend Todd Robbins, who became who's a creative genius, and he became our artistic director for the last few years of the Haunted House. He told me about that story and the, but yeah, we had one group went through the entire thing, looked out, saw the audience, and then walked backwards through the entire attraction out through the front door and left the building. So when you think about, so this is the kind of ideas in the book that I talk about in terms of control systems, that you need a lot more flexibility in order to accommodate that kind of behavior than you would if you could just say, okay, they're going to be on a moving car that moves here, or we're going to play this, you know, track from here and everybody's going to sync to that. So those things are still show control, but I think we see show control all over the place now and not just where it started in the, and I took some of the information out of the old book and put it on my blog. So I actually have a video I made from the old one that really kind of go back and trace the history of this stuff back through Disney and all that. That's up on my website and stuff. But it's like, that's where it started. But, you know, Timecode, which as far as I can tell, came from the NASA Apollo program, that synchronization idea. And I have that, I have a blog entry about that too, with the old book that I found from that.
I want to dig that one up. That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
So do I, for other reasons.
Yeah. But it's, and then, but that thing that's from the 60s or whatever, right? That's all over our industry now. Like, we deal with Timecode all the time in all kinds of live shows that the audience would have no idea that there's a clock running. You know, like, I have at Radio City Christmas show, there's a big bus that comes on stage, and I wrote the software that Media Line Manager software that takes Timecode and fires the bus out. Like, that's the old way to do it, right? Nowadays, you just get some automation console that takes Timecode in. And I, once that song starts playing, that's when I get nervous, because I know the time code's already running and that the bus is going to drive out and they're going to like spin around with the Rockettes on it with like the upstage lift all the way down with its like gaping hole in the stage. And that's where I start thinking about liability insurance and stuff. But it's like, yeah. once the time code starts rolling, that, you know, that's it. So, and they're, you know, they have a 100-piece orchestra on there, something like that. They have a huge orchestra, but every song is there's track and it's on time code. So that means pre-program the light cues, you can do sound automation, all kinds of things from that. But it's just accepted now everywhere. And I think that's like, there's no, I can't give you any data, but that's clearly like the most show control applications today is time code, one form or another. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah. It definitely seems to be the most ubiquitous. But I feel like other protocols are probably going to be, you know, coming to prominence as people find more utility in them. Which kind of gives me an idea. And I mean, when you were talking about that, it brought up a question that I had, and it's something to kind of intertwine with the educational aspect of teaching show control in this case, where it's like, especially in a university setting, I've found that a lot of people either think of themselves as technicians or designers or technicians or creatives. And one of the big challenges that I've seen, and I wonder if you could shed some light on how best to approach this, would be to bridge that gap to say, hey, you as a creative, or you as someone who is self-proclaimed as a creative, you can do this as well. You know, is there, what would you say would be the best way to kind of approach that and tell people who are just starting out with this kind of, you know, what seems like a rabbit hole of information about how to kind of, you know, break it down into easy to digest chunks as it would.
Well, that's right. And people can't see in the video, but my cat is like rubbing up against the microphone. So I apologize any thumps you're hearing. But yeah, actually, coincidentally, I have a book that explains all that stuff, that breaks it down into an easy process of that. But just two things is that, one is that I think I have, again, I've talked, referenced my blog about 100 times, but that's just where I compile everything. But I did this talk earlier this year where I finally, this is the other thing I need to work on more, but I have this thing called Huntington's theorem that if a technology exists and it's affordable and it hasn't caught on, it's not gonna. So the idea of this to me, like I saw virtual reality stuff in 1993. I saw augmented reality. I went to this crazy trade show 1993. And I was like, wow, that's cool for gaming, previz, that kind of stuff. But the guy, you know, there's this guy, Jaron Lanier, is there. And he's like, this is going to change the world. It's going to change everything. And I'm like, nah, I don't know. And I think I was right on that one. It's still amazing. But I think the pandemic proved that people don't, you know, until you get to a Star Trek holodeck thing, which just might not be, you know, physics wise might not be possible. I don't think anything short of that ever makes people not want to be in the same room at the same time. So I think, and we see this like concert touring booming, you know, theater world struggling a little bit, but I don't think that really, that's more, that was coming before the pandemic, but people are going out, you know, that's not an issue with that. So I think that, I think people who've been around a little while, like me, kind of came up in the idea that, oh, there's going to always be this new thing that replaces everything. And I think now I'm thinking that's not really going to be the case. Like there's all, of course, I'm not saying there's not going to be any more innovation, but, and the reason for that is that I think that, like I was saying about this mature toolkit, it's there. And I don't think we're anywhere near exploiting the capability. That's like that last sentence that Chris just read. That's what I meant in that last sentence. And I think to what you're talking about specifically, there was, and unfortunately I think the pandemic finished it off, but there was this great show in New York called Say Something Bunny. That was this weird little theater production of, and the basic premise was that somebody found this old recording of somebody named Bunny in Queens or something and figured out who it was. And I think it was on a wire recorder actually, and then figured out this whole thing and basically did like a documentary film live. And what they did is they passed out scripts to everybody and they came in and had people read the parts or read along the parts as they went. It was really a great production. And it was funny because just sitting there, I went into this. I just heard it was cool. I went in to see it, didn't know anything about it. And just watching it, I'm like, and I could see there was one technician who was like kind of part of the show. And I could see that they were doing something under the table, running something. And I'm just like looking at the aesthetics of the show and the technical limitation I had. I'm like, that person's running QLab. I predicted it. And of course, the intermission, I went over and talked to him, whatever. And it's like, so the reason was like, oh, the way the white cues were and this and that and the cues and all that. But the reason I bring that up is that the people that made the show were documentary filmmakers. They didn't know anything about theater. They went out, I don't know, Google or whatever, found this thing called QLab and just figured it out. So I think really now, and I think that's exactly what you're talking about, is that the tools now, it's really moved into, and you might need some help, you know, to get something troubleshot or whatever, you know, get some low level thing. But once it's set up and it's built up on a network or whatever, you know, now it's all been sort of productized. So I think that the tools are right there. And somebody like that, just a person with a brilliant idea who's not, they couldn't have done that show at that level in 15 years earlier, right? Because it would have meant you would have had to go, I mean, because, you know, when I started, like show control was a hardware thing, programmed by some guy in the closet in Hex, you know, like nobody could talk to him. And now it's just, oh, you go get a computer, you get the software, you might have to get a little help configuring these things to talk to it, a DMX address or whatever, you put some speaker into it, and they did it. So I think it's now that that's moved in software, that I think that problem kind of sorts itself out. And I think we see this all the time where, again, I talk about in the book that I think now we've like invented the paintbrushes so we don't have to invent them every show now. Cause we had to do that 80s and 90s, right? If you wanted to do something where not only getting somebody gets an idea that I want this image to float or whatever it is, sound to spin around the room or whatever it is you want to do. And now, I mean, I talk about this too, like the stuff I did in the 80s, and I was just like the kid of the side around. I can't take credit for this. Like we're talking about building production, Pink Floyd and stuff. Like, we made a unit to simulate lightning strikes and we built this thing. I mean, we meaning they, cause I thought before that I was like the kid who went out on, you know, all night operating the system and, you know, unload the truck and fix it and that kind of thing. And not get shocked, you know, in the rainstorm. But that thing, so that was like made out of photo strobes. It was a really brilliant idea with a little, you know, these days would just either be some little microcontroller, but this was like somebody made a circuit board, it fired this thing. So they had to build that and debug it and get the power and all the things you needed to do. And then, you know, nowadays that's a unit. A, you can just buy it. A strobe will just do that effect. And B, even, you know, 10 years after we did that, there was a thing came out called Lightning Strikes that was just a unit you plug in, takes DMX, and it's done. So there's really, and now, of course, all those film production, all that, which I think the really exciting development I see there is that getting, a, we built, you know, blue screens back then, green screens out of fluorescent light tubes and things like that. Nowadays, they're moving away from that into this, you know, virtual production stuff with a big circular LED wall and a gaming engine. And it really, if you go backstage and look at these things, it looks like you're backstage at one of our shows, right? It's a big video wall. It's a bunch of cam locks, a bunch of Ethernet. Putting this thing together.
There was stuff like that at Infocom this year where they literally had like it was a truck parked in the middle of like three LED walls and they showed how in real time changing landscapes, cars moving, all this stuff, the lights are flashing, and it's like, you know, it literally was a concert stage, if you will, but it wasn't as a film set. I mean, it's pretty fascinating to see it in person.
And the show that was sort of best known for that was Mandalorian. When that came out, that was one of the, you know, other people had done it, but they were the ones that kind of really make that a thing. And it's funny now because I just watched the new Star Trek, which I can't remember what it is, but now you can actually spot the LED wall, because I think you see it when you're looking.
The transition.
Well, you just see like, oh, there's real set, and then there's a circular wall upstage. That's where the video screen is. But I mean, that's because I'm a geek. Like, nobody would notice that. But I think it's interesting now you start to see like that has become a thing. But that's amazing because that gives back to the performers. They see what they're going to see, the video wall. They make the ceiling a video wall too. So it lights the set already. So they get all that from the gaming engine, from the video. And then they're interacting with all that kind of stuff. And I think I'm talking about the interactivity thing. If you look at, it's out now, the Jurassic World show that's out now. It's built on like Feld Entertainment. They do this kind of like they have the same sort of. I think you had Brad on the show, right?
Yeah, Brad. Yeah, that tour.
That was an interesting one too.
Jurassic Live. Jurassic Live, I think, is the name of the tour. Yep.
Yeah, and I think I can't remember what they got 8 inputs on that show, right? Because there's like 2 wireless mics. Everything else is the track. They basically pantomime everything. And then what they do is they use this thing called Black Tracks that. Is, you know, has a little transponder that you put on the performer. They also put on set pieces and everything else. That exports out the position through like an infrared thing, a bunch of cameras around the arena and stuff. So time-wise, they're all locked down. But then that means that the performers, they have to pantomime and they have to be in the right place in terms of the sound. But the lighting and the video and that kind of stuff will track them positionally. So that seems to be that way. If they run a little faster today, the moving lights are still going to stay on them. I don't think they have one foul spot operator on that show.
Yeah, well, and they're also once that tour gets up and running, I'm sure we can get some of that team on here. You know, there's also an immersive factor where like it's not just a left right. You know, it's moving across the arena and things like that. It's pretty. I've seen some pictures that I can't share yet of behind the scenes stuff with that thing. So it's I'm very interested to hear it, see it, and talk about it for sure.
And that's one that there's a lot of things that I know immersive is the buzzword du jour, not just in audio, but it's everywhere. And I think but that show in the arena, that's one of the places that really, really needs it because you have people in a giant costume you can't really see, they're pantomiming. And like I saw the predecessor of that show is the Marvel Universe thing, and not being a Marvel
which
guy,
is also
like
failed,
Yeah, and I had no idea what was happening because I didn't know who the characters were. It's like, oh, of course, that's Groot. I'm like, I don't know about it. So the immersive thing would be really, really important for that because it's going to would localize the sound to the giant tree thing over there. And then you're like, oh, that's that character. So there's a really good application for it. A lot of the other applications, we had the same basic idea that is now immersive buzzword du jour. We had when I was in grad school in 1980, whatever, we had this thing called AKG Delta Stereophony, which is basically the same thing. And then it became Timex. And it became, I think that falls into my Huntington's theorem about that. This has been around a long time. I don't really see it becoming, is it cool? Yeah. But is it going to be the next big thing? Probably not. Because I think it's existed for, Pink Floyd had Quad in 1970, whatever. And it's like, you know, it's pretty cool, but are you going to spend that much money to make that worthwhile? And I think some of the other things, I think it's really cool, But I think, of course, speaker manufacturers behind that, because if you can sell five arrays instead of two, that's really great for them. So, and I think we love it, and it's great. And I was, you know, cocktail party effect and everything else to isolate out those channels would be amazing. But eventually somebody's got to pay for it. And are you going to convince a promoter or the tour manager or whatever to get another truck and then more crew and whatever to make the sound 5% better? Yeah. I don't know.
You did bring up a really cool point, I think, where you were talking about how Show Control and Timecode has been has at some point kind of worked since its inception to lock everything down and make things repeatable and make things very kind of precise. And then we are starting to see this trend, it seems, where we're using Show Control in the same way, but to become more fluid and more interactive and kind of more dynamic. So it's cool where it almost has this ricochet effect where it's like, oh, we want to have Show Control, but we also don't want you to know that we have Show Control, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, but I think the idea is generally, I think the I went to this like dance performance in 1995 or whatever, where I went because I don't really understand dance, so I went to see it because they're all wired up. They had sensors on their elbow. They're like generating all the sound through. This is the early days of what's that software? Mark Caniglio. I'll think of it in a minute. But you know, I was like, oh, that was pretty cool. I didn't really understand, but I went. My date, who loved dance, I asked her about it. She's like, what? She had no idea. And the artists, again, so it's sort of like that was 15 years ago, probably more. So it's sort of like those tools have been around a long time. There's a lot of people still saying like, oh, this is going to be the next big thing. I don't think so. That's what I'm saying. People, dancers especially, and all kinds of performers are perfectly happy being just totally locked down in time. Yeah. So I think that's sort of where we are. And I don't really see that. I don't see it changing. Edge cases are always there and there's some cool art project or whatever that's going to use it. But I think I'm talking about like, you know, when you see like Radio City Christmas Show get it or something, but they're not there because it doesn't offer them anything. The audience doesn't know it's on. And again, it's not on track. Everybody's live, but it's locked down time wise. And that gives them all these huge benefits and the amount to make that, even just to do the lighting cues and make that all, you know, you can do it. I mean, to do it on concert tours for 100 years or not, well, 40 years. Somebody, you just have to have a really good operator. But even with that, with Timecode, you can program, you know, 40 cues in 3 seconds that no human being can operate every night. So you're just leveraging out the automation capabilities in there. So I don't think that, again, it has, all these things for it to be paid for by somebody has to offer something that's not there. And I don't know what that would be. And I thought before, I was like, oh, of course, this is sort of inevitable. This is like, I think I was much more techno-utopianist when I was younger. And then you get older, you're like, oh, right, I'm not going to. No, I was wrong. And I think that's why I want to go investigate what I was wrong about. Because I think there's some human nature aspect of that that's fascinating that I don't think, you know, I just want to know for myself, like, why is that okay for a performer?
Well, speaking of the human nature and I think what you're looking at, I mean, how much of that locking in is dictated by the expectation of consumption that people have come to, right? And so, I mean, there's a certain level of, would the audience actually appreciate busking more than a dedicated show that is identical for the next, you know, year and a half, you know, like just like a Vegas show where it's like we've designed this thing and that no matter who you put behind this console every night, it's going to be the same show, quite frankly, for the most part, because that's the experience that someone's being sold versus how much more would you potentially gain from an air more of artistic flair each night to night. I think humans have come accustomed to, or the general population have come accustomed to, this grander thing that is flawless. And I don't know how much they would appreciate, freestyle mixed into there. I don't know. There's something, I think that's, and maybe it's where you're wrestling somewhere in there with that.
Yeah. And I think I don't know. It's interesting because I think all these things, and I think you bring up a good point that in the end, any of these things that, you know, we might think is a good idea in the end is like, does it look or sound different to the audience in a way that they would value? And I think that I think you can go the same idea. So I don't really have an answer for your question.
Yeah,
but
sure. I know. It was more of just a
But it does bring up an idea. I think the same thing, like basically today, and this was, again, I couldn't have said this in 1990, but basically today there's no excuse for bad sound, right? Mm. And how many concerts, shows, whatever, have you been to where the sound is terrible, right?
Tons. Just go to Kyle's show. I'm kidding. Joking, Kyle. Both Kyles.
But, I mean, that this is a thing, like, the management, you know, doesn't – whoever the is advocating for the artist or whoever it is or the people signing the checks or whatever, like, they're not convinced that the audience cares enough to do that, right? So the because clearly there's no – we've had the technology for a while, and I think now there's enough skill ubiquitous in the industry that there's really no, and it's kind of remarkable, because I think about like wireless mics is like something that that's just a thing now, right? I don't know when that happened, just sort of evolved over the years, but now, and you had, I forgot who you had on, but you had recently somebody talking about wireless mics and stuff, just on a corporate show, whatever it is that you're doing. Those people exist, that knowledge exists. There's a trade for that now. There's sort of accepted procedures. There's nobody standardized that, right? That just sort of happened. So that tool is there. All these tools are there, but yet we still have bad sound on shows, right? And I think this is something I actually love to talk to you guys about it for maybe next summer or something, but I wrote a thing on my blog in like 2008 or 9 called the Concert Goers Bill of Rights. And I just wrote like 6 questions for the audience, like, can you understand the words? Is it too loud? Like, no technical thing. And, right. Like, you know, it'd be great to, like, because I think, you know, when you're spending, I mean, in those days, if you're spending $1,000 on it, yeah, I'll send you the link, because I think it'd be a good thing to, like, rally the general public for before next sort of summer concert season. Because I think it's really, there's no excuse anymore. And you could make the excuse in 1980, right? We had really crappy equipment. People were just figuring things out. It was like a new science. Okay, but that's not true anymore. We just talked about it. There's at least 10 really awesome speaker companies. There's 500 mixer, everything. We know how to do all this stuff. We've known it now for at least 10 years, you know, at a high level in all these areas. So why ever? And the big reason is I think in terms of the audience, even if they know, like, they don't, people go, you all know this, but people are weird talking about sound, right? They feel like they don't have a tool, that they need to talk in some technical language or whatever. And I think it comes from like more theatrical background where it's same thing with dealing with musicians, right? That's not their job to know that problem was at 800 Hertz and the crossover or whatever the thing was. Right.
Yeah.
But you also need to get them. I think this is what you guys were talking about in the last episode. You're talking about A/B testing and testing reality and actual truth rather than, you know, Michael Jackson recorded on this console, so I'm going to get that console and I'm going to have a hit, right? That's not what it's about, right? Michael Jackson would add a hit with that team maybe not the cheapest Mackie, but some, you know, the board didn't matter. The nice, whatever preamp they had, that wasn't the thing, right? It's just a bunch of really good people for that. So anyway, I think that's the thing in the big picture, like all these things that I think, so I think none of this is inevitable, right? In terms of other than where we are now, there's sort of things have evolved to this sort of baseline of technology because it's sort of known and understood. And I think you could, I have to think of what I can say about it, but well, the Sphere that's opening Las Vegas, right? I did some consulting on the network long before it was built. It'd be very interesting to see how that thing does. I give the immense credit for building that building and taking a massive risk to do all this, but it's a pretty massive. I went in it in November, like when it's being built, and it is a huge building. It's crazy big. I mean, it's the seating capacity of Madison Square Garden, right? It's that many people, but in a very, very specific, particular way with a really intense video system and then a very unique sound system. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that thing does, right? Because I mean, obviously, you could put Cirque du Soleil in there and have them build a show around the building, although there's not enough rigging capacity in there. But you could have something like that could draw people in. But that's a lot of seats to fill every day and do this thing. So there's an idea of like, hey, I'm not really sure if it's, you know, if we build it, they will come, right? You have to. I mean, obviously, U2 will sell out in 10 minutes, And that's the opening act in there. And they're giving, I think I read, they're giving U2 90% of the ticket sales, right? So
wow,
that's not a sustainable economic model.
Ticketmaster makes enough money.
Can I take the iPod that I was forced to listen to their music on and turn it in as a ticket? Does that work?
Right. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, there you go. That plus $1,000, yeah. Get the worst.
I want to. We did post in some of our communities to ask some questions. I do want to honor those, at least, or one or two of those. Kate had asked, "What control languages do you think are next in the world of audio? How do you see live production experiences changing given increasing implementation of APIs and AI into programming and tracking softwares?" I think you talked about this a little bit, but I don't know if you maybe had maybe a little bit more thoughts on that at all.
Yeah, I think the one that kind of surprised me over the years is OSC, which is Open Sound Control. I'm not a programmer. Like, the syntax of that thing makes no sense to me and whatever. But I think Figure 53 QM guys really sort of drove that decision because they're really brilliant people and whatever. But that has become ubiquitous now across a lot of places that I wouldn't have really thought you would need it. And the thing about, another thing is that in the 90s, when we were starting out, I was an advocate for this like MIDI show control and some of these things that were sort of universal standards that one protocol could do everything. And I think as I got older, I realized that that's not going to succeed because people aren't, you know, there's nobody that's ever going to accept any universal thing. And that B, it's actually better to not have one thing does everything. But the places where that's successful is transport. So like Ethernet and stuff like that. And something like OSC is a protocol that just allows you a lot of flexibility to do stuff. But I don't think where we are now is I think in the old days, like protocol capacity, you know, the capability, the protocols would really drive the capabilities of what you're trying to do and whatever. These days, it's kind of the other way around. I think like OSC is so, depending on what piece of gear you're controlling, it's so powerful that it's really, there's no limitations to it in terms of that other than, what's my imagination and what's the interesting idea? I think it's ideas that get people to come to a show and pay a lot of money for it. Not necessarily some other thing. And then AI, I think, is just another, like the most overhyped, thing that's, it's just like the idea du jour. Like it has, again, fantastic applications. I think it's really good for assisting people, but, I think that we, and I, just read an article that I didn't read the whole thing, but talking about how I think Herbie Hancock just wrote an article talking about jazz and stuff about how the performers now are more important than the music. And I didn't read the whole article, so I'll send it to you guys when I finish. So that actually just supports exactly what I was going to say, is that I think to me, the music's important, right? The way that we emotionally react to it. But I think what we're reacting to is the art of that, you know, the songwriter, the performer, whatever it is. So I have no interest in what some computer program wrote. Like, I don't really care about some software's opinion of anything. Right. So I'm not that threatened by AI with that. And then also, I was in the, Grand Canyon this summer, like I'm trying to run this river since 1999. And I was down there. One of the guys on the trip was a, intellectual property lawyer. And he said something mind blowing to me that he's now going to have, I don't think it's been announced yet, but he's going to, I hooked him up with a trade show and he's supposed to do a presentation to our industry later this fall, but output of AI, public domain. And I was like, right.
Yeah. Interesting.
So if you have AI generate your album art or your character for Disney or whoever, it's public domain because only a person can copyright something, right? The computers, you can copyright the software, although a lot of AI, like they, no one's really writing it, right? So but you could build the AI structure, copyright, patent that, but the thing that it generates can't be owned by anybody. It's public domain. So if you have AI generate a song, it's public domain. So this means corporations are not going to be happy about that, right? So
that's that's a whole nother thing that I certainly want to investigate and talk about.
I think it's, again, it just becomes, it's, you know, I think the writer's strike and all that's happening as we record this, like that's really about a horrendous residual situation and really scummy corporate practices where they won't release their viewership and those kind of things that, you know, that's what that strike's about. I think AI is in the mix, but that some AI generated script, like, I don't know. And I tell you, just one funny, two funny things I got. I think I had Google Bard and I had the Microsoft one. So I wrote it, I told it to write a bio of me. And mostly it was like scraped off my website. So it's pretty much what I wrote. But one of them, I think it was the Bard, actually he said, I don't know where it got this, but it confidently stated all this information correctly. The last sentence said that I won the Tony Award for The Lion King on Broadway, which A,
congratulations.
Yeah. A, that was Tony Meola. And awesome. B, they didn't give Tony Awards for sound when that show was open. So it was wrong on like two counts. And then
just take it.
Yeah, yeah. Accept it. I just don't tell Tony. He's the one who deserved it. But I mean, it's a pretty easy to fact check that Tony Awards didn't exist when Lion King opened for sound. That was a big controversial thing. We tried for years to get that. And then the other one, I think it was a Microsoft one, mostly had it correct. And the last sentence was, he lives in New York City, which is correct. And it said with his wife and two children. I'm like, wow, I guess the AI must have generated. I'm not married. I don't have kids. So I don't know. But it just states it confidently. Obviously, these things can get worked out. But
sure,
they got a long way to go. But I also think in the end, you know, what we do is as technical people, we help artists, you know, communicate their vision to the public or the audience or whatever. That's what I've been doing my whole life. And I now have a lot, I feel like I have many more things I want to do with that. I'm not interested. I think artists might use some AI to help them create. I mean, it's a good idea generator and things like that. But even you think about what's the Gorillaz, right? That's sort of the animated band, but that's what's his name that wrote the music, right? So you're hearing, I'm drawing a blank on his name, but you're hearing his music. It's being performed by virtual, whatever, but it's still with somebody, you know, you can Google the guy and find out, you know, where he, you know, what his life is about. And I think that's what we're relating to those artists, like telling us something from their life that's important or whatever. And again,
absolutely.
So an AI basically just predicts what it thinks the next word should be. That's not, we don't really understand anything. So there's a long way to go before it's any sort of threat, I think.
And I think especially with the generation of content, I think to your point is like, there's that uncanny valley type effect where you know it's not human generated, but you can't put your finger on why. Yeah.
But you should probably explain uncanny valley if people don't know that term.
It basically, if something looks almost human-like but not quite human-like, you have a visceral, like, you have this reaction to it where you feel uncomfortable when you see or hear something that's almost human but not quite. And that's what the uncanny valley is. So, like,
in animation and stuff, that means is why things get, they make them very cartoony, because obviously you could make,
exactly,
we have the capability now to make animation that's very lifelike. And you see this in, like, video games and stuff, but it always looks a little off. Like, there's because that last 3% to make it really real is, like, that's what the old saying about, you know, the last 10% of the work takes, you know, 90% of the time or something, right? So the solution is you just make it more cartoony and then it's believable. But yeah, I agree.
Exactly. Like, a lot of it's the similar thing with the movie example I always go to is the adaptation that they did of the Polar Express, where they tried to make them the characters hyper realistic, but then it just kind of looked it didn't look right. I actually did have a question because I seeded a couple prompts, Chris, as well, and this one comes from a Discord server called The Green Room, and this was actually asked by a couple of people, and they wanted me to ask about your thoughts on integrating departments onto one network and having a dedicated network IT department kind of in the general show structures and moving forward with that, and getting your thoughts on how that would be.
Yeah, that's another interesting one. And I saw, I probably shouldn't have tracked it down, but it was on Facebook. Somebody had posted, like, I think it was Lion King was on tour somewhere, I don't know, whatever, Minneapolis or somewhere. And some networking expert, apparently, you know, seemingly very knowledgeable, with, you know, scan the Wi-Fi. And is like, oh, look at these idiots. You know, what do they do? They don't know what they're doing, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, okay, clearly this guy may know a lot about Wi-Fi and he should write an article for ESTA protocol about it. But he doesn't know anything about how a show works. So in that case, all of us know that, you know, the sound department, it was rented from this shop, and it's whether it's theater or concert tour or whatever. Lighting came from this shop. Scenery came from somewhere else. All these things came from somewhere else. The amount of effort it would take to integrate all that, I think in most cases, there's no real, like, the cost-benefit ratio isn't worth it, right? Where you can to integrate things into that in terms of Wi-Fi or a shared network or whatever, usually I don't think is worth it, because the lighting department, they have switches from, you know, Pathway or wherever they like. They have procedures for dealing with that. Sound department and video get it from Luminex or whoever, or Netgear now has a really good line of switches, right? So they get them, they like those and all that. But, you know, what you can do, though, is if you want to have communications between departments, they'll all speak to each other, right? You can easily plug a cable from this one to that. So I think in general, there has to be a really compelling reason to share things on that in that way, because in the end, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, that I, you know, sort of reliability and stuff. So you're going to do a show where your front of house position is across a river, you know, or a stream or whatever, and you're only going to get one piece of fiber, two pieces of fiber, like, okay, we got to share, right? But in most parts, if everybody's spooling the thing out of the truck in the morning to whatever, it doesn't really matter. So there's not a really big benefit to integrating things. And then if you want to have the departments communicate, that's where you really want to just coordinate IP addresses and get a router, right? Or, you know, have one of the switches do it. That's the way to do that. I think that, I don't know if I answered the whole, I forgot the other part of the question.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh. But that's a big, you know, it depends. It depends on. So I tell you, in the haunted house, we did it because I was in charge of the network for all the departments, and a theme park, like, they used to, you know, they used to keep separate switches between departments. I think now they're integrating it because they have, on a Disney attraction, they have a shared maintenance department, right? So there's a compelling reason to share all that stuff and put it all in one system. But I think for the most part, for standard show stuff, I think it's more common to keep them separated, because there's not really, unless there's a really compelling reason to bring them together.
Exactly. Like you were saying, it's a very compelling reason. And I mean, in my brain, you know, from a safety standpoint and a redundancy standpoint, it seems to be a lot more sensible to have separate networks for everyone, but that might just be my own.
And that brings up a good point. If somebody kicks the plug out of the lighting switch, you know, hopefully the lights will freeze in that state, but the audio keeps going because I was on a different switch. So that idea of redundancy in there, and in the book, I have these sort of design principles I go through that covers a lot of this. Doesn't get into specifics a lot of it, but it's the general process for those things. So I think in that case, like, the redundancy is a much larger benefit than, say, and switches in the big picture compared to a console switches, even the most expensive show switches are cheap, right? So, and I always recommend you don't want to be running your show on a Home Depot switch. You don't want a consumer grade anything in there anyway, because that'll cause you all kinds of problems. But I think, you know, you want to spend some money on this stuff. But even in that case, the stuff is pretty cheap.
So, you know, obviously, we're certainly going to have you back on. You know, I want to go down a whole rabbit trail on education. We certainly do not have time to go down that right now. So let's put that on the back burner. I did want to say about the book is, as a kid who was more inclined to pull out the comic section of the newspaper growing up, as opposed to maybe reading other things, the first thing I did scroll through your book through was like, oh, what pictures are in here, right? I did appreciate your two makeshift GUIs in here, the Purple Floyd Show Control, and the track is Comfortably Rich, and then a nod to your cat, Popsicle Wolf, the Puratorium. Anyway, so I appreciate when anything of such depth and technical can bring some light and humor into the manual, or this isn't a manual, but you know what I mean, technical guide. The last nod to that of appreciation, that the best manual that ever did anything like that I think of in the past, quite frankly, is what Mackie did with all of their manuals. The humor that they were able to sprinkle into all of their manuals is phenomenal. I don't think any other manufacturer has ever been able to touch that level of that. So anyway, all right, go ahead.
I was just gonna say the last example in the book is one giant Simpsons reference in there. So that, and all that, some of that is back in the book since I've updated everything, but it's from, and the Pink Floyd references from the 90s too, like, still is relevant. And the other one, right. Popsicle Wolf is clearly, It's this thing called Meow Wolf, which is an immersive art experience. They're insane. They're multi-million dollar corporation now. I think there's four of them, but it's basically that. I didn't want to like ask them permission to talk about, and also those things get dated. So yeah, that's the,
sure.
But those are all supposed to be sort of realistic examples, but I tried my best to make it, not be as dry as it could be.
Sure. So certainly, link in description for both John's, his site, which has all his blogs we've talked about. Also put a link to Rational Acoustic Store where you can buy a bundle of two books, or if you want to get the ebook and go to other places, go to John's site, things like that, right? I would encourage, we had some of the questions on Facebook Discord. I'll answer for John in that. I'm sure he'll maybe go and respond to some of those. If you have some more questions that maybe this sparked, feel free to ask him in there. It's a good place to have those dialogue. But I do want to, let's just close the one last question because I don't know when the next chance we'll get a chance to talk. And I didn't get to ask you this question last time because it didn't exist then. If you could define your legacy or how you'd want to be known, how would you define that?
Oh yeah. I think it's funny. We didn't go through all that last time, but, I don't know. I think I'll be dead, so it won't matter much to me, but I think that the way I try to live my life is try to live that now. Right. So I hope that, I've certainly been an asshole to some people, but I try really hard to not burn any bridges and try to respect people. And I learned, I've just learned a huge amount of that, like teaching in a inner city school for 24 years. And you see what these kids go through. Like that's just humbling every day. And that, so I think that for me, so I think that that's sort of my goal is to, have people, think that I was at least nice to them now, and try to, and I think, there's that idea of, I can't remember who said this, but the idea of like, you have an idea and you share it now, there's like two ideas or whatever. Like, I think that's the thing to me is like, I always try to be around people much smarter than me. And I've done that for most of my career because you're always trying to learn. That's the interesting thing to me is to learn whatever else there is. And just like, I always enjoy. So people, if they have a question or something, please email me, or post it or whatever. The Discord server I get a little overwhelmed with sometimes, so there's just so much traffic on there. But if you tag me, I'll probably see it. But most things like that, I like to talk, talk to people about that because I learned stuff about, like, oh, this happened and whatever. So, but yeah, I think that's sort of, I don't know if I had a really good answer to that, but.
No, it's good. I appreciate it.
Just looking through your bio and your website, like you're a true asset to this community. And thank you for writing another book, and thank you for the books that came before. And we'll have to have a discussion. I want to talk more about this haunted house because that just seems fun.
Yeah, and there's one really good YouTube walkthrough of it, and they're gonna make. We're not going to do the big thing anymore, but they are going to make like an escape room version that I'm not involved with because I'm out of there. But that they're going to be doing something this fall with that. But I'll find out more about that soon.
Awesome.
Cool. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And this won't be the last time we talk.
Sorry, do you want to talk about the book giveaway?
Oh, shoot. Dang. Yes.
Oh. He's keeping secrets.
Yes. That's right. So this is the cool thing is this. All right. So Club Rutabaga, those who have been have made it this far, an hour and a half into the podcast at this point. Yes. If you would like to win or a giveaway of a book, John has graciously created a link that I'll put in the description. I'll put it in our communities as well. Sign up in there and John will work on giving away a copy of his book. If there's anything you want to say to that.
Yeah, and I think I'll give one print version of each and one e version of each. So four people.
Great.
Or just select them randomly. So
cool. Awesome. Well, if you made it this far, you deserve to earn one of those. So
anywhere else. Only if they really listen to the end.
You didn't win it.
That's right.
You didn't win it. You earned it.
Yeah, that's right.
There you go. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you guys. This whole thing is, I've said it before, but I think what's, you all have created here in this community around this thing has been awesome. And, I'm jealous that I didn't have something like this when I was 20 years old, because back then I was just shut up kid. And it was very difficult. The whole world has gotten so much better in all those ways. And I think you guys have done a really very cool thing with us. And, you know, bringing up, you know, people into the industry was great. And just demystifying it and you know, making the whole thing, all of that stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's certainly becoming a driving force to create something that we all would want to have had existed when we were coming in, right? That's certainly the driving force behind this. So I appreciate that.